Court of Appeals for the State of Nevada is now in session. Honorable Chief Judge Silver presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We have on for our first case, Charles versus Omniterra Solutions, LLC, case number 68440. And I want to say again, good morning. And if both counsel, when you approach the bench, make sure that you state your name for the record as it's being recorded. Okay. You can proceed at any time. And would you like to reserve any rebuttal time?
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Sure. Okay, come on up.
If it pleases the court, Eric Olson appearing for the appellant, Jeffrey Charles. The appellant asked this court to reverse and remand to the district court its decision denying a second writ of mandamus with instructions of the court to consider and rule upon the Henderson Justice Court's plural compliance with her earlier limited remand. The grounds on which Judge Alf at the district court denied the second writ were purely based on lack of jurisdiction, but certainly the court had jurisdiction, inherent jurisdiction, to review the limited remand that she had mandated to the justice courts. Although it's not a case directly on point with that proposition, Ryan's Express versus Amador talks about the inherent power of the court to the courts in this state to issue limited remands, and also the inherent power of the court and authority to carry out the basic functions of the judiciary, which we believe would include looking at what happened on remand and then considering that.
We were wondering how Steve George stayed out of this.
That's a good point, Mark. I wondered a few things about this case. And I looked at, it's a fairly convoluted record, and I know the court allowed us to supplement recently with a clearer picture of what happened in the minutes.
You would spend your entire oral argument explaining the record if you wanted to go through everything that happened.
I think I'm going to cut it a lot shorter than that, Judge.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Didn't you do exactly what you were complaining of? You reopened a closed case. This was a statistically closed case.
I mean, here's the thing. Just to follow up, here's the thing. Every petition for writ of mandamus is a separate case. Why didn't you just file a motion to enforce in the first case with the first case number? Why open up a second case with the second case number and open up all these potential jurisdictional issues?
Well,
that's really the more detailed version of her question.
I will acknowledge that it would have been preferable. Of course, the appellant was representing himself at this point.
Right.
And I think that it would have been preferable. It would have perhaps cleared up an issue. However, once the matter got statistically closing a case, isn't necessarily, as the court knows, the conclusion of the case. And by bringing it back in front of Judge Alf, the idea was, you've made this ruling. You've said, this is what I see. This is what I need you to do. And it's taking a look back to see whether the court complied. Now, initially, the justice courts complied, but then there was a sea change, in a concluded case, which is the very strange part of this. I mean, so you have, at a point when these cases go back to the justice court, you have a ruling from Department 3 that says, yes, this is a dismissal without prejudice. Then you have a judgment gets entered into Department 1 in favor of Mr. Charles, and everything seems to be correct. What then happens is a couple things happen, but to make the short version is a motion for reconsideration gets filed in Department 1 but heard in Department 3. And there's never been a ruling in Department 1. There's still a judgment. But Mr. Charles is in jeopardy because apparently if he executes on the judgment, as he attempted to do through a writ in November of 2014 and January of 15, writs of execution, he'll get sanctioned. That's what happened. But again, there's never been a ruling in Department 1. I've checked, scoured the docket. Despite representations that there was some sort of a hearing on February 6, 2015, to vacate the Department 1 judgment, there's no record of that hearing in Department 1 ever, and there's certainly no entry of a judgment. So instead, what you have now is you have this sort of fugitive ruling of Department 3, which, by the way, if Department 3 had been the recipient of a motion for reconsideration under 59E, it couldn't have determined because it was way outside the timeline. So you have the same kind of arbitrariness going on as Judge Al saw in the first instance. And
what stops you from filing another petition in district?
Well, perhaps the question then would be, I mean, a separate petition. I suppose.
What stops you from doing that?
It seemed like, first of all, it was done. It seemed like judicial efficiency to proceed with the course of events as they had been taking place. This is a complicated enough docket that it seemed that this appeal had been commenced when we became involved in the case to follow through with that and then get a ruling from this court. I mean, if you look at the arguments they've raised on the other side, they don't really hold water either. They don't. The respondent doesn't say, well, in fact, the court didn't have jurisdiction. They raise issues about inviting error is the primary, the idea that if you, it's almost like saying, you know, by filing with the district court, you took your chances the district court was going to mess up. That's kind of the argument, and that's not.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, just structurally, right? You have what's going on down in Justice Court, and it's a mess. You have two judges who are at least arguably doing incompatible things and doing things that are extremely difficult for Mr. Charles to follow. You have Judge Alf, who issued an order which appeared to be an attempt to clarify that, right?
Yes.
So, just as a practical matter, right, the one person who knows what Judge Alf meant is Judge Alf. What you're asking us to do by doing it this way is, the three of us, we're not Judge Alf. Now you're juicing a whole other set of judges, right, into this whole mess and saying, okay, you want us to interpret what Judge Alf meant when she was talking about what these two other judges meant. Why didn't you just go straight to Judge Alf and say, Judge Alf, they're not complying with your order, you need to do something about this because the one person who knows what you meant is you.
Well, that's what Mr. Charles attempted to do. He sought a second writ. And at that point, the judge said...
But the problem is the second writ's a separate case. Why don't you just file a motion in front of Judge Alf and say, Judge, we need you to enforce your order. I can think of a couple things just off the top of my head. A motion to enforce, maybe some sort of motion, order to show cause to find somebody in contempt if they're not complying, something like that. But bring it in front of Judge Alf instead of filing a whole separate case number with a whole separate...
The same case number. But it was a separate writ petition.
Right. I mean... I think it's difficult to conceive of filing the order to show cause would be an order to show cause directed to the Justice Court.
Right.
And I think that the instinct of the appellant was understandable that you would go back to Judge Alf. Now, filing under a separate case number and getting potentially a random assignment to another judge might have put you in the same position because, you know, Judge Alf is the person who knows what she meant the first time. And when you look at... And as far as going to you, to this honorable court, Judge Alf, what she meant seems pretty clear on the second go-round. She said she didn't have jurisdiction. And that's really the extent of what she said. She said she didn't rule on vexatiousness and all the stuff that's raised outside the record by respondents, but she said, I don't think I have jurisdiction to oversee the Justice Court. Well, I don't know that in a separate action, that would be better. Isn't it better to have come to her in that action and say, Judge, the reason you get to oversee is because you've made a ruling in this case, and this is really about the Justice Court's compliance with that ruling. So if you bring in a separate case, A, you may end up with another judge who doesn't know Judge Al's mind any better than this court does. And B, you know, you even if you end up with Judge Alf, aren't you faced with the same problem, that she may feel that she doesn't have that jurisdiction? Whereas this is really, what was done is more of a continuum of the initial action. Judge, please look at this. She did. She made a ruling. It was not complied with. And to go back to the same judge would make sense. Now, yes, another mechanism that could be used before Judge Alf in this existing case, perhaps that's a way to go about it. But again, I don't know, as I'm standing here thinking about what that would be, I think the court's guess is as good as mine, and I think there are problems with taking the approach, for example, of in order to show cause, because you're directing at a court, whereas...
I thought Dave Gibson actually testified in district court before me before on a case of what he did as a JP on a totally separate criminal case. Well, ironically, he actually was a witness.
And I'm sure that Justice of the Peace is a fine jurist and a fine person. I don't know him. But I think in this particular case, as we all do, there are errors made, and that's what we're trying to find a remedy for Mr. Charles. Again, he embarked on a remedy, and that's why we find ourselves here. But I don't think it's wrong-headed, because I think you really have to look at what are the other options, and it made sense to go back to this judge, to Judge Alf, and try to get a determination. I reserve some time, so I'll talk about their opposition if it comes to that. But it's really inexplicable what happened. I mean, to have rulings from another judge on a separate case. And I can tell you, I would love to be able to say to Mr. Charles, go ahead and issue another writ in the Part 1 case because you have a valid judgment. But the court appreciates the jeopardy that he's already been exposed to. And I ask this court to send the matter, since we are here, back to Judge Alf for the judge to take a look at what actually happened. And as a follow-up to her own decision, she may make a decision that we don't like, but I think it's hers to make.
What do you think would happen if we do not rule in your favor? Where does it leave this case?
Well, I think it leaves the case in limbo because you have a concluded case in Department 3, and you have a judgment. We have two concluded cases, I guess. You've got a judgment that he can't execute upon in Department 1 without putting himself at risk. If the court ruled against him, might we, this hearing is the scope of my representation at this point, but might we consider other options? We might. I don't have those in mind as I stand here. And with that, I'll reserve rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Sigal Chatto, on behalf of Respondent, OmniTerra Solutions. To say that the docket on this case is lacking, I think, would be an understatement. However, what I believe both the appellant and myself can agree on was that on September 8th, 2014, a motion for summary judgment in favor of the appellant was granted. Okay. On October 14th, a motion for reconsideration was heard by Judge Burke. And for me, it's easier to simply identify Judge Burke versus Judge Gibson. At that hearing, he decides to send it back to Judge Gibson. Who, what, where, when, and why, we don't know. However, remember, Judge Gibson had already been divested of jurisdiction the moment that he had sent it to Judge Burr, the subsequent case, for procedural and litigation on the merits. At that point, it is our position that at that point, the writ of mandamus should have been filed. Okay? Why? Because you have a judge that is presiding over an open case, remanding it to a judge with a closed case that has divested himself of any jurisdiction.
And what authority can you even cite that you can sit and file documents in a dismissed case?
Well,
which is what eventually then happened.
As far as, okay, so we file a motion for reconsideration. The judge heard that motion. No opinions were issued. Nothing was issued from the bench. He simply says, okay, motion for reconsideration heard. Let me send it back to the judge, to Judge Gibson.
And you weren't there.
I was here. Yes, I was there at the motion for reconsideration. I was at the hearing, and I think everyone was a little baffled because at that point, well, wait a minute, you're the judge that is supposed to be presiding over this case. Judge Gibson has been divested from any jurisdiction because, now this is after the writ of mandamus had been issued by ALF saying, now Judge Gibson, you're to issue findings and facts and conclusions of law. So at that point.
But he followed the mandamus. He said it's dismissed without prejudice.
Correct. And he sends it to Burr.
Right.
He sends it to Burr.
And then it
goes back.
Motion
for summary judgment gets filed. Burr grants it. We file a motion for reconsideration. Motion for reconsideration heard. Motion for reconsideration, then we don't have an order. We don't have grant or denied, but obviously, since we are now at either judgment entered or reconsideration, Burr sends it back to Gibson, who shouldn't have had any jurisdiction because he was divested from jurisdiction. At that point, back in October 2014, that was the time when a writ for mandamus should have been filed with the Judge Alf to say, wait a minute, Judge Gibson has no jurisdiction anymore. Judge Burr should have the jurisdiction, and Judge Alf should have mandated Judge Burr to proceed with a motion for reconsideration, conduct the discovery, and so on and so forth. Okay? But what happens, there's no writ of mandamus filed. And that is why our position is that this is invited error. If you do not file a writ of mandamus and request that the court, which would have been Judge Alf, had either compelled Burr to continue hearing this case procedurally, whether it was to reopen discovery and so on and so forth, that was what should have been done. Failure to do so, one, invited error.
But now you're filing all kinds of documents in a case that's closed.
Well, it wasn't closed. It wasn't closed because then it was reopened.
But Gibson's was dismissed without prejudice. How do you just reopen and start filing docs? Where's the authority for that?
Well, because Judge Burr sends it back to Gibson. So now Gibson is the presiding judge. The case is reopened. Judge Burr divests himself from jurisdiction, sends it to Gibson. Now he compels Gibson on November 25th, 2014, to hold a status check on the motion for reconsideration and then hear the motion to open discovery. So at that point,
you could have done a motion reconsideration.
I'm sorry?
Maybe you could have done a motion to reconsider reconsideration.
Reconsideration. Well, here's the thing. I think we were all baffled at what was going on. This is Henderson Justice Court. I don't think anybody at this point knows, well, do we argue with the judge? Wait a minute. I mean, at that point, you're supposed to retain jurisdiction over this, not send it to a judge who's divested of jurisdiction. And so we all followed Judge Burr's order. So now we're in front of Judge Gibson. And now Judge Gibson opens discovery and allows us 90 days for discovery. Once we're in front of Judge Gibson doesn't say, wait a minute, I'm not allowed to preside over this hearing because I divested myself from jurisdiction. So we're caught between two judges who wrongfully send the case back and forth. There's no question about it. Judge Burr should have retained the jurisdiction, should have proceeded on the merits and allowed us to litigate this on the merits. However,
But given all this complexity, the remedy for that is to go to a higher court, which in this case is a district court. So why, let me ask you this question. This is the flip side of the question I asked your counterpart. The second petition, granted it's filed by a pervert, doesn't have the right title on it, but why can't we construe that as a motion to enforce the prior order from Judge Alf. She said she didn't have jurisdiction because she construed it as a writ of mandamus, but why can't we construe that as an enforcement motion because it asked for similar relief that wouldn't have, in fact, the second petition wouldn't have been necessary if everyone had just followed the first order that she issued.
I believe that Judge Gibson did follow the first order of mandamus. Mm-hmm. He issued findings of fact, conclusions of law, statistically closing the case in Department 3, sending it to Judge Burr for determination on the merits. Mm-hmm. Judge Burr then decides, I'm not going to determine this on the merits. I'm going to hear the motion for reconsideration and send it back to Gibson. So a second writ of mandamus is, I believe that Judge Alf issued the right opinion denying the writ of mandamus because at that point, the only time the writ of mandamus should have been filed was October 14, 2014, when the case got switched back to Gibson. Because procedurally, that would be the way to have done it.
But wouldn't that be a whole new, that would be a whole new action then?
Well, no, I don't think so. I actually think that if a petition for writ of mandamus would have been filed following October 14th, 2014 hearing, before we even hit the status check in November, the petition would have been filed. At that point, I believe Judge Alf would have probably, I'm not going to speculate, but procedurally speaking, I think that Judge Alf would have probably issued a writ of mandamus saying, Judge Burr, what are you doing? You're supposed to retain jurisdiction over this. You can't send it to a judge who statistically closed the case. So that's where the doctrine of invited error comes in, and that is why we cited to the doctrine of invited error. Now, after the February decision, at that point, once the appellant had acquiesced to having Judge Gibson rule on the motion to reopen discovery, he had waived a right to have a writ of mandamus issued against Judge Burr. Why? Because we're now, you're acquiescing to jurisdiction in front of Gibson. You're appearing at hearings. You're responding to motions in front of Judge Gibson. You can't now say, well, Judge Burr, you made a boo-boo. So the...
What law can you cite that you can sit and file motions in an action that was dismissed?
You can waive personal jurisdiction, but you can't waive subject matter jurisdiction. How is waiver even a thing?
Well, here's the thing. At that point, Judge Gibson was the presiding judge. So I'm not filing any documents in front of a judge that has a closed case. The case got reopened by virtue of the fact of Burr transferring it to Gibson.
He didn't transfer his case number. In fact, the minutes show that that still appears to be open.
Well, we have two open cases.
Right. You have two open cases.
Correct.
So it wasn't truly transferred.
Right. Okay.
Because if you transfer in district court, it would
right,
be.
Right, right, right.
And I, he would, if I transfer, he gets my case, but it's the same
correct.
Case number. You have two open cases right now in justice court.
Which is kind of crazy because the cases are precisely the same cases.
And the things that are getting filed are in a case that was dismissed.
However, at what point do I question a judge's ruling when a judge tells me I'm sending this to Judge Gibson for a status check and to rule on the motions? At that point, what am I supposed to do? I follow the judge's orders. So when the judge orders me to go back to another judge, that's what I do. And I continue to litigate it in that department because this department has kind of divested itself of jurisdiction by bouncing it back to another judge. So we're caught in the crossfires here. I mean, for lack of a better term, we are caught in crossfires. We have one judge that issues this ruling, bounces it back to another judge. I follow this judge's rulings. He tells me I have 90 days to conduct discovery. This judge didn't get involved in that. Send it to this guy. So I use 90 days to conduct discovery. And then I file a motion to strike. So herein lies the fact where are we at this point? I believe that a writ of mandamus, if it would have been written or should have been filed, should have been done back in October.
What stops appellant from filing a brand new writ in district court right now?
They could file a brand new writ, and then we would provide our position on why the writ of mandamus, at this point, almost 2.5 years later, I would say that there were issues and timeliness and so on and so forth.
Well, let me ask you this again, follow up on my question. You can't waive subject matter jurisdiction. If one court does not have subject matter jurisdiction over this case, okay, then what, if you're saying this is not the remedy, then what is the remedy when you're in a court that you believe lacks jurisdiction over the case? What is he supposed to do now?
At this juncture?
Right. Or ever, because, you know, you keep saying you should have filed this writ back at a particular time, but if the court never had subject matter jurisdiction, that can be challenged any time, including for the first time on appeal.
Okay. What I believe the remedy would have been is to appeal the February 2015 decision by Judge Gibson. That was our position. That has always been our position. Because essentially, with this writ of mandamus, what they wanted Judge Alf to do was to micromanage two justice court judges. And I believe that in her opinion, for lack of better term, she says, it is not my jurisdiction to micromanage two justices' proceedings.
It is her job to determine a writ.
Correct.
And if that involves justice court, then it involves justice court. That is her job.
Correct. But the manner that the writ was drafted was to request from her to issue a ruling on the fact that one judge had sent jurisdiction over to another judge who had a case that was statistically closed. Because in Gibson's, to justify what Gibson did, he did follow the writ of mandamus that was issued. He did issue findings of fact and conclusions of law.
So this would be another writ.
I'm sorry?
Would you agree then it would be a whole different writ because it's a different writ to a different judge, the transferring judge?
What?
The first writ involved telling Gibson to write findings of facts and conclusions of law.
Correct.
As to whether you dismissed it with or without prejudice. That was it. That's all
Correct.
The writ was.
And that's what he did. And then he sends it over to Burr, and Burr hears a motion for summary judgment. And then Burr hears a motion for reconsideration and says, you know what? I'm sending this to Gibson.
Well, the good news is Burr's gone now.
Well,
he's in city now. Now, I don't know if that's good news or bad news, but
unfortunately,
maybe for the underlying litigation.
And here's the thing. Unfortunately, because this is not district court and we don't have the quality of minutes that we would have in district court and we don't have the quality of record that we would have in district court, we're working with really minimal dockets here. And that's where I stand, and with that, I rest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just briefly. It's interesting listening to the argument of counsel because it makes me think that everything took place in Department 3 after the final judgment is simply void. And there's just really, none of it really is, the court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction, it really is essentially void. The idea that the error made, the invitation of error by my client is simply the timing of when to submit the writ, I think is a bit of a trap because you have, and I think it would be a trap probably even if he was a lawyer, because it's hard to know when you have this ruling, these rulings, as counsel said, I mean, they're proceeding in front of the second judge who really had no jurisdiction because, you know, what do you do? So is the error in simply not requesting at the time of that transfer, Mr. Charles requesting the writ at that point? I don't think it can be. I'm processing the court's comments about a motion to enforce or a separate writ. Perhaps
you think he just wanted to avoid a filing fee in a new case?
Oh, I don't think so. I think it's a question of, I think even a lawyer would be uncertain what to do. At this point, you have a judge who's made a ruling, and a motion to enforce would seem to make some sense. I think the thought is that a second writ is like a motion to enforce. It is that judge going to that judge and saying, Judge, here's what's happened. Give me a ruling. It's not quite procedurally correct, but the idea is the same. And to...
Ms. Jacques, I just said it should have been an appeal then after that final order from Judge Gibson rather than a writ.
Well, but again, what are you going to appeal? You're certainly not going to appeal. You have a judgment in Department 1. So you're not going to appeal that because that's what you want. I mean, to appeal the... What happens in Department 3 is really kind of meaningless because, except for the fact that you get sanctioned.
Right, but you can appeal and say this court had no jurisdiction, so we're back to what Department 1 did, which was issue a judgment, and that's what you want.
Well, again, I think it's a difficult call when you have a morass of activity. You have a final judgment that you want in this hand, and to say, on the other hand, I need to go back and fix this other thing through an appeal rather than a writ. I think that's a difficult thing to ask of anyone, a lawyer or non-lawyer.
Thank you both so much. We appreciate your time and effort that both of you have put into this. And
the pro bono.
Thanks again. And I know that this was also a pro bono case. Both of our cases today are pro bono. And I know the attorneys are here, some of them on the other case too. And we recognize that and thank all the lawyers for their service.
I'd like to thank the court for
this. This may be the last one you might take, huh?
I don't think that's different, but no less.
Thank you.
This case stands.